Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week, meditation instructor Eric Weinberg continues our study of Chapter 3 of the book Cultivating True Compassion by Trungpa Rinpoche. The title of today's talk is Training in Bodhicitta Part 2, A Higher View. Moral discipline is the basis for all Buddhist cultivation, but great masters of the past joined that discipline with a higher view of reality as being the unity of emptiness and appearance. Trungpa Rinpoche discusses the Vajrayana tradition's view in general, and the Mahamudra and Dzogchen views in particular. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, good morning, everybody. Ooh, that's nice. I should have brought my harmonica. Well, today we're entering the third chapter of this book, Cultivating True Compassion. And it's kind of an outline of what we call the three trainings, which is one way of breaking down the stages of the path of meditation, and talks a little bit about their benefits and all that. I think in the website, on the little whatever it is, notification that goes out, Lama Kathy called it a higher view. I don't know how much higher this view is, because actually it's me that's talking, so we'll see what happens. I think I'm going to fold in, I don't know, some personal comments about working with prisoners as well, simply because it's been on my mind a lot, and it seems to fit in with this. So bear with me when I drift off into some personal stuff. In the Dharma, it's the job of whoever is teaching, and it doesn't, in some sense, matter who it is. Some of us are more, further along the path than others. But regardless who's up here, even if it's an ordinary person like me, my job is really to present the Dharma in as clear and clean a way as possible without altering it because of my own lack of development or understanding. But also, more importantly than that, is my job here is to feel compassion for each person that hears it and for each person that will be affected by each of you because you did hear the Dharma. And so for me, this just sitting here, in a sense, is a call to engender a higher view of compassion. The job of the people that hear the Dharma is to hear it and take it in a discerning way. In other words, and it goes into this in the chapter, we all start out with some kind of faith. We want to believe stuff because we think it'll make us feel better. And life can be difficult, so we all want to feel better. Life can be pretty random, or seem pretty random and be difficult on some days and maybe a little bit too good on others, and we never know which one's coming when we get up. So there's a certain amount of stability to listen to the Dharma with, in part because it helps all of us to train for stability with whatever dharmas come our way in life. It's taught that our teachers are representations of the Buddha. Yeah. I know, crazy, right? And that the content of our life, depending on us, can be actually the Dharma. Dharma's a lived thing. It's not just what's in the books. What's in the books, and the books themselves are sacred, there's no doubt. But the content of your life, the content of your thoughts, all of that, when you add discernment to it, also is the Dharma. This is part of the higher view of bodhicitta. And then lastly, all the activity, whatever's happening, good or bad, is the action of the protectors. You know, I can't tell you how many times it's occurred to me that something really horrible happened, or I thought of it as really horrible. I didn't get something I wanted or something like that. And I see from, you know, perspective a couple months later or something, that I was really lucky not to get that thing, whatever it was, because it protected me from something, whether it's a relationship with a client or, you know, whatever it is. Sometimes when things fall through, actually it's a protector working also. Sometimes when things come through that are surprising, that's also the action of the protectors in your life. So when we think of taking refuge, see, I'm segueing into the refuge thing now. When we take refuge in Buddha, which is the teacher, the Dharma, which is the teachings, and in our case, for hearers of the Dharma, those teachings aren't just the books, but they're everything. And the Sangha. And the Sangha is certainly us. It's certainly all the past, present, and future enlightened beings, bodhisattvas, if you were, that surround us at all times and support us if we just remember they're there and kind of lean in and ask for help. And we can do that with each other too. As an ordinary Sangha, we can lean on each other, and we should. And the more we do it, and the more we give each other chances to develop compassion. And ultimately, compassion is, while it's not entirely sufficient for total enlightenment, or so I've read and heard, it is absolutely necessary. So by leaning on each other, depending on each other, yeah, it's risky because we're all human beings and things can get cocked up, there's no doubt about it, but also it gives us all a chance to cultivate compassion in a way that's totally integrated with our lives. So this chapter is a lot about, you know, the backdrop like that, but it's also a lot about what you do on the cushion, what you vow to do in order to develop the muscles that you need in order to live your life in this kind of refuge with Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Does that make sense? So those are the three jewels of refuge. The three roots are Lama, Yidam, and Protector. So, Lama is the person that actually is in our life and in our heart, because being humans, we connect to each other heart to heart. It doesn't have to be just a mystical connection to an invisible being or force or historical great person or something like that. We find ways to open our hearts with surrender and devotion to people whose job it is to be compassionate towards us. Yidam is, Yidams are what we visualize enlightened mind to be like. So when we do a Chenrezi practice and we visualize ourselves as the bodhisattva of compassion, made of light and so on and so forth, and also that he's above your head and 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 your head. I feel a little like Oprah, you know. You get a car and you get a car, you get a, in this case, a vehicle. And then Chenrezig dissolves into you and you also become Chenrezig. That's Yidam, is seeing, again, it's training on the cushion to be able to see life in a different way and regard everyone, the ones we like and the ones we don't like, as having the same essential nature. And protector is the activity of Yidams. They're clearing away obstacles or creating them where we're about to go off the rails. And they say, wait a minute, we're going to help this stop now. So within the Vajrayana practice of Buddhism, which is what we're engaged with here, we're engaged with a bunch of exercises that are extraordinarily well designed. I don't know, some people here might like what I'm about to say, and some people may not. But I think particularly on your home practice, if you're doing like Chenrezig practice or another Yidam practice or some mantra practice, your native language is English. Do it in English. You got a translation, use it. The chants are beautiful, the music's beautiful. Do that sometimes too, because there's blessing in that. But in and of itself, your mind needs to engage this stuff. You need to know what it says. You need to, in order to, you know, they say meditation, contemplation, and action are the three, these three steps. In order to meditate on something, you have to understand it. In order to contemplate it, you have to understand it. In order to take action in a skillful way with ethics and so on, you better know what you're doing. And those are all requirements. So I encourage you all to practice a lot and to do it as much as necessary until essentially it's ingrained in you in your own language, so that, you know, your understanding can be ignited and it can deepen and deepen and deepen. And you'll come on your own to this higher understanding of bodhicitta, because it'll be your direct experience. And that's the point. I find that, you know, these practices that we're given aren't, as I don't know why I'm a judge on this, but for a minute, as guided meditations go, they're extremely good. Talk about well-designed. I have no trouble, once I understand them, seeing that they were transmitted to us by enlightened beings. I have no trouble seeing Kempo Kartha Rinpoche and all the others as enlightened beings, because when I do the practice as instructed, at least in my own language, so I can understand what's going on, I start to experience life in a different way. And that's the point of the higher view of bodhicitta. So with that in mind, let's chant the refuge prayer together, but let's do it with some understanding that we're actually taking refuge in infinite, one that has infinite compassion for us as individuals and us as a group. And you can make that group, you should make that group as large as possible for you. And that we take refuge in those teachings because they actually work once you understand them. That's why I put that little plug in for practicing at home in English. And we take refuge in all the support from all the enlightened beings and from each other. And there's brilliance and opportunity to really improve, particularly when we lean on each other. And that's the whole point. We want to create those conditions for us to wake up. So when we chant the refuge prayer, it's until I reach the heart of enlightenment, until I wake up, I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, three jewels. By accomplishing generosity and all the rest, which is the six perfections, those are the actions of a bodhisattva. In other words, this is the way these great supports work. I'll enumerate them before we chant it, just so you understand. The first is the perfection of generosity. If you have a sense of your own limitation, that's fine. You also have more potential than you know, and your generosity can be perfect. And it can be limitless. And one of the reasons we get on the cushion every day is we wear off a little bit of the stuff that obscures that perfection and limitlessness. Ethics, which is just basically, you know, all boils down, do no harm to yourself or others. The very first teaching, that's ethics. And then there are all the little detail-y pieces and that's for somebody else to talk about. Patience. We all get frustrated, every single one of us. I've seen people I regard as highly realized get frustrated. And the difference is that when they get frustrated, they don't think, oh, I'm so bad, I got frustrated. No, they just say, ah, it's time for me to employ patience. Because patience is the antidote for anger. Being in samsara, stuff's going to piss you off. That's just the way it is. So cultivating patience, the perfection of patience, is extremely important. Joyful diligence. It says in this chapter 3 here that I'll get to pretty soon, I hope. There are 9 levels of stability and meditation. I probably won't go through all of them because nobody will remember them anyway. But they're in the book if you want to look them up. The 5th one, though, is called Taming the Mind. And the description is one feels joy, enthusiasm, and relaxation in meditation. This is what joyful diligence means. It's all of a sudden you've practiced enough that you really look forward to it. That cushion is a happy place. That was from a movie, wasn't it? The happy place, I don't know. So we make steps towards home or our happy place simply by practicing every day. And joyful diligence is something where, you know, situations arise and we can apply ourselves. And we're happy to have the opportunity to apply ourselves rather than just coping with the crap of it, whatever it is. It's like, oh, yeah, okay, I can work with this. It's all workable. it's all workable is kind of the lion's roar when you confront your life and you see that it's all workable. It's like you've got courage, you've got joy, and you've got diligence all in one package. Then, of course, meditative stability. And meditative stability is just something we develop by practicing every day. It comes. You get all those goodies. You get the ability to concentrate. You get the ability to remember. You get the ability to be clear. You get the ability to be discerning. And out of that grows the sixth perfection, which is wisdom. And wisdom, when you really can discern what it is that's appearing in your life, and you can see all the interdependent connections, guess what? Lights go on. Seeing that is wisdom. Wisdom is the chief quality of enlightenment. So this path is, it's important to understand it. It's important to contemplate it. And when you say the refuge prayer, it's important to understand that's what you're buying into, is you're taking refuge in your own enlightenment. So, for those who know it in Tibetan, please chant along with me. For those who don't, it's perfectly fine. Just follow along in your heart with the thought in mind that you're taking refuge in your own enlightenment. It's going to happen. Sanje Chudong Soki Chognam La Chang Chu Pardu Dagni Kyap Su Chi Daki Jin So Gi Pe Sunam Ki Drola Pinchir Sanje Ruparsho Sanje Chudang Soki Chognam La Jang Chu Pardu Dakni Kyap Su Chi Daki Jin So Yipe Sunam Ki Drola Pinchir Sanje Ruparsho Sanje Chudang Soki Chognam La Jang Chu Pardu Dakni Kyap Su Chi Daki Jin So Yipe Sunam Ki Drola Pinchir Sanje Ruparsho. So Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva view, the higher view of bodhicitta, I think the first thing is that it won't come from my words, it won't come from a book, it'll come from your practice. That has to be said, but it's good to have some information. So I'm here to give you some information that is contained in this book, and I encourage you to pick it up. It's a good one. I heard a joke this week that I liked, and it was like, one guy's hollering across a lake at another guy on the other shore, and he said, "Hey, how do I get over to the other side?" And the other guy said, "You are on the other side." And I first thought about that as being like a story about empathy, and, you know, we're both on the other side, and you know, and all of that kind of, and you wake up to who you are and where you are and blah, 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 all that stuff. And then I thought about it again, and it was like, "Hey, Dave, How do I get to the other side? You are on the other side. I don't care. There's a fire behind me and it's gaining. How do I get to the other side? And I think that's sort of the way it is here. It's kind of like once we realize that there's a fire and it's gaining, we realize that time is precious and we don't have limitless time in this life and in this body and with these circumstances, all of which are incredibly favorable. And who knows what's next? It's really important. Some of you probably know that I do some prison work, and one of my Dharma students was executed about a month ago, 3 weeks ago, something like that. And I'm still not totally okay. We talked about this a lot. After he got his date, in one way, while it was horrific, and he certainly had some psychological reactions, he actually suffered from PTSD, and so, you know, in prison, a lot of buttons get pushed, and he did some stuff from time to time that got him in trouble. In fact, one of the guys was being kind of mean and teasing him after he got his date. And as Karma Bob would say, he liked to be called Karma Bob, I let him knock me off my square. And so he turned around and he cold cocked him. And I think he broke his jaw. Anyway, he got thrown in solitary for the time before his execution. And I saw him there. And we talked about how to practice. And he said, you know, actually, that guy did me a favor. And I said, what do you mean? Because solitary is really nasty. He said, I don't want to be around a lot of people right now, just with the normal mundane conversations and worried about which TV shows we're going to watch and all that. I actually need to be alone. I need to be in a cell. I need to practice. I need to prepare for my death. So he did me a big favor. In a sense, he was like acting like a protector, because he would have just ended up being on the range and, you know, having the normal life of a prisoner without having, and he would have never ever, I mean, he would have practiced every day. He did practice every day, but he wouldn't ever buckle down, so to speak. So at the end, he was just much more prepared. And that was a powerful thing. He would say that he had an advantage having a date because he knew what was coming. We don't know what the date is. We don't know if it's this afternoon or 30 years from now or 50 or whatever. We don't know. So we're in a little bit different situation. And when Trungpa Rinpoche starts out this chapter, what he says is, he starts it out essentially with a question. He says, so we take the Bodhisattva vow. Why is a vow necessary? We all agree this is good stuff. You know, wisdom and compassion in union is a good thing. I don't think anybody would argue with that. Why is a vow necessary? And he said, well, it's because sometimes we think of generating bodhicitta as being appropriate and necessary and the right thing to do. And sometimes we think it's just too difficult. And the reason that we take a vow isn't that we're going to feel any different about things. But when you know that you've taken a vow, you got that little wiggle in your brain that says, I took a vow. I took a vow that I'm going to see this situation as workable, and I'm going to do this as skillfully as possible with as much kindness and compassion and wisdom and discernment as possible. No matter what form that might take, that's going to be my motivation. That's going to be my aspiration. And he said, when you have that vow, since our lives are precious and yet indeterminate in terms of their length, you can keep coming back to this. And you can remember it a little bit better. So the vow is there in service to us. It's not there as a like a magical spell. Sometimes we do things with this idea that it's magic. Like if I do this mantra enough, this will happen. Or if I do that, maybe it will, maybe it won't. But that's not a good motivation. What's a good motivation is I'm doing this for the benefit of all beings. I'm doing this to grow. I kind of have carry two things in my hip pocket. Bodhisattva vow, there's a short version, a long version. It's a lot to hold in your head. It's a great experience to take it. But for me, it boils down to two simple things. One is cultivating the wish to grow. In other words, don't waste your life. Grow. Just grow. We already know the six perfections. That's what I'm growing towards. Just grow. And the other is the title of Garchen Rinpoche's movie, which is For the Benefit of All Beings. Seems like if I carry those two things in my hip pocket, it gives me at least a general understanding of how I can be in my life in any given day. So I vow to cultivate the wish to grow, and I vow to at least aspire to do what I do for the benefit of all beings. That's the vow. And it's good to have it. Good to figure out for yourself how you will take what you know of the Bodhisattva path and the Bodhisattva vow and figure out your own two catchphrases that you can carry around in your hip pocket. You may steal mine if you wish, but it's always better to figure them out for yourself, because then they're really in there. You won't have to work to try to remember what he said or what I read or whatever. So anyway, having a vow is important. And if the opportunity comes up to take the Bodhisattva vow, Lama Kathy gives it from time to time, and I think it's particularly wonderful to take the Bodhisattva vow from her, because she's very generous in explaining it and takes her time and gives you the best opportunity to figure out which catchphrases you're going to carry around in your own hip pocket. So, Trungpa Rinpoche says approaching bodhicitta that way actually is a source of tremendous and never-ending benefit. Enough said. The root text for this book is Atisha's Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment, as some of you may have remembered. There are all kinds of formulations for the path. In this particular book, this is like a three-legged stool that we're going to find our seat on. And the three legs are, first, moral discipline. Like I said, that can get extreme. There are five vows that you take as a layperson, and you can take some of them or all of them. And they have designations for that. Like if you take four out of the five, it's kind of like they call that the almost complete vow. And so on. The second is training in samadhi, or which is simply getting on your cushion and doing shine every day. I think that gets short shrift for a lot of us because we take on a practice and we're doing a chanting practice all the time. And sometimes we take it on before our samadhi is really grounded and solid. And our shine is solid. And so we do the chanting practice as a chant without using it to train the mind in concentration. And if you can do a chanting practice and whenever your mind wanders, bring it back to the practice, okay, that's shine inside of a chanting practice, that's good. If you can't, however, and you drift off into fantasies about what you're doing or thoughts about ruminations about the past, worries about the present or future, then you need to do more shine. Simple as that. Simple as that. Those things will all come up for all of us because we're humans, but we got to be able to let them go and bring the mind back to its, what shall I say, sacred root. And whether you do that with the breath, with a candle, with an image of the Buddha, with a chanting practice, that doesn't matter. But that's the second leg of the stool is samadhi. Training our minds to do that is really important. And the last part is discernment or wisdom. That's the third thing. Actually, if you do the first two thoroughly, wisdom kind of arises. You kind of sit. Kenpo Kartha Rinpoche was asked about this once, and he said, sometime if you train really well in moral discipline and in samadhi, you will sit down on your cushion one day as an ordinary person and get up as an enlightened person. In other words, wisdom will dawn. It's just like the best of all side effects of all these practices. Great. So, moral discipline, for us lay people, I'm just going to run through them because I don't want to take up all the time for this. Not killing, we probably can all agree on that. Not stealing, not lying, and avoiding sexual misconduct. Those are the four main ones. The fifth one is don't take intoxicants. That's regarded as a branch vow. Not getting intoxicated actually supports the other four. That was what the Buddha taught. So, you know, sometimes when people get drunk, they actually harm themselves and others. Sometimes they get lost in their desires and maybe they'll take something that's not given, which is the definition of stealing in this case. It's not just taking what's not yours, it's taking what's not given. Not lying. Well, you know, there you go. Inhibitions go down and sometimes fish stories go up. They're just how many stories of guys with 12 packs of beer in a fishing boat and how big that fish was that they caught. You know, that happens. Avoiding sexual misconduct, it's obvious. So that's what it means that intoxicants support those other, the four are the main vows, and the fifth is the branch, it's the support of those four. It's just good to know that. For monastics, they have a lot more vows. And there are different levels, and there are hundreds for somebody like Kenpo Kartha Rinpoche. I don't know how many vows he's got, but it's in the hundreds. Lots. The important thing about all this, though, once again, isn't that we get granular. It's not like a Protestant work ethic thing where we fail and then we beat ourselves up and worry about, you know, going to hell or something like that. It's not like that. it's a framework on which that we begin to develop this constant continuity of mindfulness. We know what we're doing. It's like we look at what we're doing. We see it. It gives us a chance to grow. That's the point of it. It isn't to try to make good people and bad people, or make us feel bad about ourselves or good about ourselves. It's not to go to Rinpoche and try to get a pat on the head because I didn't do this or I didn't do that. It's like, if you do that, by the way, you'll be very, very disappointed in his response. It happened to me. I just know. This isn't about getting pats on the head. This is about you cultivating your own mindfulness. That's why it's considered a higher view, this particular chapter. It's not the obvious surface stuff. It's about how we're growing. So the second training is in samadhi, and I described that a little bit. The point is that we develop tranquility. That's why it's called calm abiding or tranquility meditation. We develop a certain amount of tranquility, a certain amount of unshakability, certain amount of equanimity simply by doing this practice. It's an incredibly well-designed practice. It's incredibly simple. And if it's not simple, you're probably not doing it right. I think there are a lot of pop meditate. I know there are a lot of pop meditation teachers these days who try to make things fancy or showy in some way, and that just gets in the way. The simplicity of it is the power of it. It's simply resting your mind. That's it. Simply resting your mind. And then when your mind moves, you recognize it and you simply bring it back to rest again. Very gently. With a really good attitude, you know, you kind of do it with, I went there, fresh start, and you just come back to rest again. And if you do it again and again and again, you kind of get used to that, and your mind is going to like it. It's really being kind to your mind, so when your mind really likes it, and you're really kind to your mind, you know, you'll be inclined to cultivate that joyful diligence. You'll be doing it more. You'll find yourself walking through Kroger's, standing in too long a line and doing mantra instead of doing frustration and impatience. And thereby you will also cultivate patience in a very good way. It has a lot of benefits, but it all starts on the cushion. And that's what the whole second point is. It's like an important leg of the stool. Discernment, the third one, is important. You really have to be able to see how things are, even if they're incomprehensible. And if you read any of the wisdom literature, just read the Heart Sutra, man. You can get lost really easy. And that's a cool way of getting lost, and it's a cool thing to read commentaries and hear teachings about it. Sometimes if you see things how they are, actually they're incomprehensible. It's weird. Seeing is not believing. The things we believe, the things we have faith in, are generally illusions. I'm not saying having faith is a bad thing. Having faith in the Dharma and having faith in authentic refuges is a good thing, but you have to understand you're not actually seeing how it is. And if you do this long enough, you will catch a glimpse of that and it will be incomprehensible. And that's where the wisdom of discernment comes in. And that's where the importance of tranquility really comes in, because you see it, and rather than thinking about it and getting lost, you just rest in it. And then you have a moment of authentic Mahamudra meditation. That's what happens. That's how it happens. And for people who have realization, they kind of live there all the time. So, faith without discernment is not such a good thing. it can, as Trungpa Rinpoche says, can become mistaken. He said devotion is best accomplished with discernment. Just having a kind of blind devotion, and I won't elaborate on that, it's just not a good thing. Discernment is really critical. So what does that mean? That means you have to be able to ask questions. It means you have to be conscious enough to be able to ask questions, even if they're uncomfortable questions. People ask me uncomfortable questions all the time. I see people in here who've asked me uncomfortable questions. It's good. That's really, really, really good. So, and what comes out of that is when we all drop our answers and we work with each other to see how things actually are, which is a state beyond our concepts, beyond, as we say in the books, conceptuality, we might catch a glimpse of the way things actually are. And we can do that together. That's one of the ways Sangha actually supports each other. So that's the three legs of the stool. The three legs of discernment are hearing, contemplating, and meditating. We talked a little bit about that in the beginning. You hear the Dharma, you contemplate it. So you have to hear it in English if you're an English-speaking person, because you have to contemplate it. And then you have to meditate on it, which means fixing it in your mind and then letting it go and seeing how it is, how things actually are, and seeing how those things come together. So the incomprehensible becomes comprehensible. That's the gift the Buddha gave us. He saw it. He got how it was, and he was able to express it. So we can, when we can rest enough to be with the incomprehensible, and then we have contemplated the Dharma, and the light bulb goes on, it's like, that's what he was talking about. Then a certain connection is made, and it becomes something solid with which we can grow and benefit beings. And when we say, by the way, benefit all beings, that includes ourselves. I just want to make that point. Some people miss that, and that's important not to miss that. So, it's about a quarter after, and I want to say one quick thing about Ma Mudra. I kind of mentioned it already. Ma Mudra is this union of shamatha and vipassana. Shamatha is this resting of the mind, which is why it gets emphasized so much. Vipassana is this discernment or insight into the way things are. So when you get to this place of practicing Ma Mudra, and generally in our tradition, you complete Nundro and then you get some instructions. But really, we all, just by being here, by practicing what we practice, the way we practice it, we all get it regardless. And the idea is that if you are doing Chenrezig practice, and at the end of Chenrezig practice, it says that with the first thought that re-arises after the dissolution, you say to yourself, I'm Chenrezig, and you actually see it that way, and I actually see you as Chenrezig, at that moment, whenever that hits, doesn't have to be at the end of the practice, could be at the beginning, could be not in the practice, it could be at Kroger's. Whenever that hits, instead of grasping onto it, just rest. That was Tilopa's instruction. Don't try to change anything. Be in this present moment and rest. That's the instruction. So everything that we talked about leads up to this practice called Mahamudra, which is the same as Nidhyamaka, which is the same as Atti Yoga, which is the same as Dzogchen. Mahamudra, I think, is the simplest and most accessible, particularly for us, because we're connected here to great Mahamudra masters. But that's the trick. Practice a lot. And when those moments happen, and they will happen, because these practices are incredibly well designed by really smart people, masters, you'll catch a glimpse. All you need to know is at that point, don't grasp, rest. So that's it. That's the end of my talk. If there are any questions or comments or whatever, the mic is open. We've got like 10 minutes.
Thanks, Eric. You reminded me of something that happened to me this week when you said being patient in the grocery store line. I was in a grocery store line this week, and it was a little longer than I would normally have preferred, but I just said, I'll just accept whatever weight I have. I got into this real calm space.
Yeah.
And the next thing I knew, the guy behind me is tapping me on the shoulder saying, they're opening that line next to it. Do you want to go ahead of me?
Oh, cool.
I said, sure. So I zoom, and I'm out of there.
Nice. You know what? When you said weight, my first thought was W-E-I-G-H-T. That was nice. Yes.
Hi, Eric.
Hi, Arvin.
Experiencing my impermanence as I get up from the cushion. I'm getting old.
As Bill Clinton often said, I feel your pain.
I was having a correspondence with a teacher recently about a kind of one of those aha moments we have in practice where kind of like
the... Can you get a little closer? I can hardly
yes,
hear.
I can.
Thank you.
I met her in Monterey.
Anyway, yeah.
Kind of like where, you know, like the ness of emptiness and bodhicitta and all that stuff kind of hits you at once. But I was trying to describe, like, I was talking or writing, and, you know, I was like, how do you describe that, one of those moments? And I was like, well, is it an emotional realization? Is it an intellectual one? Is it both, or is it neither? And I was actually, I mean, sometimes I come up here and I'm just kind of like setting up the teacher, like, you know, I have an idea of, I already know the answer, or at least I think I do, and then I kind of present it. But this is actually one of those times where, like, I don't have a clue. I'm actually...
Well, I think if you can put words on it, it's not the real thing.
Of course.
Because words are just conceptual symbols for
sure
that approximate experience. Lama Yeshe Jamso used to always say, these are analogies.
Right.
And analogies, by definition, are imperfect.
Right.
If they were perfect, they would be the thing it themselves.
Right. Of course.
So there's that.
Sure.
I would say this. I have some analogies that may be useful.
Right.
Or an observation. This also comes out of the execution. One of the things I had to tell Karma Bob was, you're going to have a lot of sensations. I mean, this is not a comfortable thing. You'll have a lot of emotion, and he did. And you'll have a lot of thoughts, a lot of things you're trying to hold on to.
Mm-hmm.
And your senses are going to start shutting down.
Mm-hmm.
And your consciousness is going to shut down. Why? Because it's a function of what your mind is doing with sense impressions.
Sure.
So as your senses shut down, your emotions shut down, your consciousness shuts down, and yet, if you've learned how to rest with whatever arises, even something like death, this is the whole point, really, at the end, because we all die, right? You learn to rest and bear awareness. That's what it means. But there are no words.
Sure.
Because consciousness is done.
Right.
You're leaving the brain behind. You're leaving the heart behind. You're leaving all the senses that have brought you all the information your whole life behind.
Sure.
So resting and bare awareness, getting the practice of that, is of incredible importance. That's where all this stuff we're talking about leads to, ultimately, getting stability in Shine, developing bodhicitta, identifying with who you ultimately are, visualizing yourself as a Buddha, mm-hmm. not this body with these organs and so on and so mm-hmm. forth. That's what it's all about, mm-hmm. so that you can rest in the bare awareness, and then that is guided by aspiration into whatever the next form is. So if you aspire for something mundane, you probably get a mundane rebirth. That's what all these texts are talking about, right?
Right.
If you aspire, on the other hand, to something sublime, you probably, that's what you'll be attracted to. Does that make sense?
Oh, no, it totally makes, yeah, that totally makes sense.
So
to me, it does.
So I usually just allow it to be like, I imagine, this is the analogy I use. When I come to the place in my meditation where I'm experiencing directly, like being a cloudless, sunlit sky, I just rest. Drop everything. There's no words. The mistake is to go to try to find some poetry to write about it.
Of course, yeah.
Right. Yeah, don't do that.
Okay.
You know, I think it was...
So like a Naropa thing, both and either nor?
Yeah, Milarepa, now I'm going to misquote him badly, which I apologize ahead of time. He's like, if you can rest meditating on water, mm-hmm. then be the waves, be the water.
Right.
I mean, the wave doesn't know it's any different than the water, right?
Sure.
The water doesn't know that a wave is arisen, right?
Sure.
It's just, but you have to have that moment that you were talking about in the beginning that you're looking for words for. Mm-hmm. You have to have that moment, but instead of looking for words for it, just rest.
Right.
That's my advice.
Sure. Okay. No, that's good.
Is that helpful at all?
Yeah, it does. What you said was basically sort of what the teacher said, which just was like, don't grasp it, just let it experience it and let it go.
Yeah.
So, but okay, thank you.
Hi, Sue Ellen.
Hello, Eric.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Actually, I am back. I'm just back from KTD.
I know.
And we had a lovely Waitara retreat. We were chanting Waitara for the benefit of our teachers and their longevity, as well as the benefit of all sentient beings. And so I guess I'm kind of making a plug for, when we're talking about language, I agree that, yes, you should read your sadhanas and stuff in English. Yes, you should understand them. But there is an incredible amount of power in chanting them in a language which, no, you don't understand and you don't read and you're just saying the syllables, but that's the way it's been for 2,000 years. And there's been a lot of people that did that before you, and there's a lot of merit associated with doing that kind of practice. And merit is the basis for accumulating wisdom. So whether you know what you're saying or not, it's okay, but you can say the refuge prayer, and if that's all you said for your entire life and believed in it, And if you dedicated the merit that you thought you were getting for that, and you did it for the benefit of all sentient beings, you would find your next life to be probably really remarkable. So this isn't coming out as quite as clear as it was in my head when I thought about it, because I guess I made it sound more like a commercial, and it's not. It's just a wonderful opportunity. I mean, you don't have to get, you don't have to read a lot of Dharma books. You don't have to do a lot of, you know, it's wonderful if you can do that. Everybody's got different levels. Everybody's got different standards. Everybody's got different understanding. But when you start putting language in it, just like you were telling Arvind, then you get a lot of confusion. You let it get a lot of contrast, and you get a lot of controversy. And usually, that's just based on words that we made up anyway. Just doing the practice, being in the practice, and chanting with lots of other people doing the same practice is wonderful. And then remembering that you're benefiting all beings is generating merit, and remembering to dedicate the merit at the end of the practice is keeping that merit and expanding that merit out into wherever it goes for however long, which is infinite, it lasts. It's just, and it's not like you end up feeling all, ooh, wonderful, and all of that. Sometimes it's a bloody pain. I mean, my voice goes, you know, because you're chanting a lot, and it's just, but it's really easy to do. You just go, and you just do it. You don't have to think. You don't have to really understand. You just do it, and eventually, you do get one of those wisdom moments, not that I have or expect to, but anyway, so if you ever have an opportunity to go up to KTD or to participate in some of the practices that we do here, I can highly recommend it. Thank you.
I do too.
Well, I was there too, and I tended to notice that well, I'm kind of like a polyglot.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
I'm a polyglot.
Oh, you are? Okay.
I tend to notice you were emphasizing the reading of the English language. I kind of like the text, the chanting text. They have Tibetan there, too, so you can, like, get to learn the Tibetan words if you're curious enough. That's just me.
I actually like chanting them in Tibetan, don't get me wrong. I really, really, without reading it in English, I don't understand what is going on when they talk about what we're doing,
younger.
That's all.
The only other comment I was going to make, like when I started out, I was like that, oh, Chinrezi, I don't understand it and everything that you get a lot. But then I watched a webcast in India. Every year they do the Karmakagyu Munlam near Bodh Gaya. Beautiful practice. And one time it struck me, I had the book, I was chanting along and everything. There were people from all over the world. There were languages, Norwegian, Finnish, Spanish, all kinds of, you know, yeah, German. You can practice Vietnamese, Chinese, just a ton of different people. They were all chanting the same words for the same purpose. It was just incredibly beautiful and powerful. And you can see it still because it's on the webcast and everything. So I'm sorry, Ron, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it was just, okay.
Well, I wasn't trying to put down the idea of chanting in Tibetan, but I will say that in order to fulfill the requirement for higher bodhicitta of discernment, you have to be able to discern. And, you know, that is one of the reasons that the Sanskrit sadhanas got translated to Tibetan, frankly, It's one of the reasons Marpa translated all that stuff he got from Naropa into Tibetan, was that the Tibetans needed to understand what was going on. He realized the good of it because he could he knew both languages. And he said, whoa, this stuff is awesome. And I would say it's part of our tradition. Some people call the Karma Kagyu the practice tradition. There are other monikers for that too. But so practice is preeminent in this tradition. But everything that we get from the core teachings right from Marpa indicate that we have to be connected to discernment. And it's just part of us being who we are. What you're saying is right. Doing the chants together, accumulating all that merit and dedicating for the benefit of beings is of inestimable value. But in terms of being able to engage in the path, walk the path, and really be of benefit of others on the path, we have to have discernment. We have to understand. So I say you got to be at home reading it in English so you know what's going on in order to do that. And then practice like crazy. I prefer getting together and doing our practices in Tibetan once I know what they're about. Having grown up Jewish, I had the same issues with Hebrew. Even though I went to Hebrew school, I didn't really know enough Hebrew. I knew a lot of Hebrew, but it still wasn't enough to really know what was going on. And then once I got a rabbi that was willing to really unpack it for me, I was very lucky. I saw how extraordinarily precious and beautiful, powerful it was. It helps the growth part. So my own feeling is it takes two wings to fly a bird. And one of them is the aspiration that you personally have, your wish to grow, that has to cultivate it every day. However you need to do that. You know, once you aspire to goodness, let's call it bodhicitta, just make a vow to grow in that. And also, you need the wing of doing it for the benefit of all beings, which sometimes is much more effectively, done by chanting in the same language as everybody else and sharing that around the whole world. It is very powerful to think about that. So anyway, I don't feel like we're contradicting each other at all. I really think particularly this chapter of the book is saying, you take a vow. This is the first paragraph, basically. Here's the reason why. And it all has to do with you need to engender this. It's not a matter of the tradition or anything else. It's our own. We need to do this. Anyway, I've talked much too long. And so let's take a moment and dedicate the merit of hearing, contemplating, and meditating on the sacred Dharma for the benefit of all beings. that the lights of moral discipline, samadhi, and discernment would come alive in every single living being. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.